Jared Dubin of Last Night in Basketball joins me to say something nice about the Houston Rockets, the Orlando Magic, the Phoenix Suns, and Tom Thibodeau, as well as the Nets, Bulls, and Hawks. All that and so much more coming up right now on this episode of Divine Intervention. Here's wishing you the bluest sky and hoping something better comes tomorrow. Hoping all the verses rhyme and the very best of choruses to follow all the doubt and sadness. I know that better things are on the way. John Gennaro, count me in!
One, two, three.
Today's first words belong to The Kinks from their incredible song Better Things off the 1981 LP Give the People What They Want, but the rest of them belong to me. Welcome to Divine Intervention, a self-help podcast about basketball. My name is Dan Devine, and before we get rolling, here are three things that I am grateful for today. Number one, I get paid by Yahoo Sports to write about the NBA and talk about it into this microphone and into that camera. Pretty good deal. Number two, the way that listening to Better Things by The Kinks also makes me want to listen to the cover version of it that Fountains of Wayne did, which is a really easy way to turn 3 good minutes of my day into 6 good minutes of my day. And number three, the fact that I get to improve even more of my minutes by spending part of my morning talking to an old friend in this game whose work just keeps getting better and better. My guest today is a wonderful writer and analyst whose work has appeared at ESPN, CBS Sports, 538, Grantland, The Ringer, and Sports Illustrated, among other publications. These days, you can find him providing sharp-eyed, wide-ranging, well-researched coverage several times a week, every week, at his newsletter, Last Night in Basketball, of which I am a proud subscriber. Friends! A warm welcome for Jared Dubin. Jared, thank you so much for being here. How are you doing today?
Thanks for having me, man. That was so nice of you to say all that. I appreciate it. And I've written for so many websites that have shut down.
I don't think that you're like the harbinger of the demise there, but if nothing else, we can certainly trace an era in digital publishing by your byline. So there's something to be said for that.
Yeah, that's definitely true. It's been a while now that I think about it. You know, I started doing this, I was a law student, and it's been a while.
Well, the good news is that the things that you have learned along the way in terms of, you know, I'm sure there's legal matters that you're able to speak on, but also the fact of like how you move through the world that is continually moving quickly behind you. These are good things that are going to hold you in good stead over the course of your career as it moves forward. And that kind of reframing is sort of what we're going to do here today, where we take a bad thing like the publishing industry and we try to turn it into a good thing. The premise of today's episode, Jared, I've asked you here because as we get closer to the end of the regular season, I kind of feel my brain getting pulled in a bunch of different directions. And after spending the last few weeks digging in on specific teams, I wanted to bounce around the league a little bit and find some silver linings, some glass half full takes, some optimism in different situations. And so we're going to play a game of say something nice about today. This is kind of the general idea. Since noticing stuff on League Pass is one of the staples of your coverage, I figured you would be a very good person to do that with. You're not just locking in on one team. You're kind of bouncing all over the place. So let's bounce around together. What do you say?
Sounds great.
All right. We will get into that. But first, here on Divine Intervention, we always try to operate from a place of joy. So, Jared Dubin, what is something from the world of basketball that has brought you joy this week?
So I'm glad that in your email you mentioned Josh Hart specifically, because everything about the Josh Hart experience is bringing me joy lately. Like, not just the 6 triple-doubles in 6 weeks after not having one for 6.5 years. Literally everything he says seems to be like the best quote of all time. Like, after DiVincenzo hit whatever it was, 47 threes against the Pistons on Monday night, Monty Williams was like, "We don't want to be part of that story." And then somebody brought that quote to Hart and he was like, "Well, you should have played better defense." Like, everything he says is gold. Like, we need to protect him at all costs. So everything about the Josh Hart experience is giving me joy lately.
I completely understand that. I appreciate it. The fact it's weird, like you would imagine he wouldn't have the energy to be funny after playing, you know, 1,000 minutes a night for 2 months straight. But he seems to have an endless reservoir for that. So I love it. I love the play on the court. I love the sort of effervescence off of it. Absolutely right. Josh Hart secretly made to play in New York, and it has been a delight since he got here midway through last season. One way for us to generate more joy in the realm of Josh Hart, sort of that vein, is by reframing unhelpful stuff in a more positive light. Monty Williams says, we don't want to be part of their story. Josh Hart helpfully reframes that as, you should tell your guys to play better defense. Negativity can take many forms. We talk about that kind of stuff a lot on this show. It can be not providing enough praise for good behavior, good stuff we see, giving too much attention to the bad stuff we see, obsessing over one bad thing, like the little bit that didn't go right, to the detriment of acknowledging all the good stuff that happens. There's lots of ways that we can have sort of negativity encroaching. So we're going to take a little time here today to accentuate some positives. And we're going to start out with a team that has, until recently, not really gotten very much general fan attention on shows like this one, you know, national and august platforms like Divine Intervention. So, Jared Dubin, say something nice to me about the Houston Rockets.
I am, like, scarily all in on Amen Thompson. Like, the degree to which I love watching him play, it's like, it's borderline should be illegal. Like, I love watching that dude so much. Him and his brother, like, obviously they're extremely similar players. I feel like Amen has, like, even more burst than Asar somehow. And he's everywhere defensively. He's, like, a connecting piece offensively. And he's rebounding like crazy. He's, like, basically playing the five on offense for them since Alperen Şengün moved out of the starting lineup. They didn't have Jabari Smith on Monday, so they had Jock Landale out there with them on Monday night. But, I mean, I love watching that dude play so much. So that's – if I have to choose one thing, it's that one thing.
Well, the good news is we're allowed to talk about more than one, but it's a wonderful place to start. It's in my notes as well. Like, you mentioned Şengün moving out of the starting lineup. He suffered an injury. That's the kind of injury that – like, for a team that was in as sort of precarious a position as Houston was, like, young team, they're kind of trying to fight from underneath, get back into the postseason picture. Your main guy goes down, that could be, like, a defensible reason to just, like, fold up, right? And be like, all right, well, we gave it a shot, but not going to be our year. But we've already made strides this year. There's something to feel good about moving forward. But Amen Thompson being that kind of piece that you can plug in and reimagine in different contexts, and Ime Udoka being the kind of head coach who has had success kind of figuring out, like, don't tell me what this guy can't do. Let me figure out what I can use him to do. You know, that was the Robert Williams example with the defense in Boston and playing two bigs together like that. Amen Thompson suddenly becomes like, they go small and they're like, we're going to be a small ball lineup. Jabari Smith Jr. is going to kick over to the five. We're going to play Amen at the four. Jalen Green. We'll get to him in a second. Just have a lot of good young Jalen's on the brain. It's difficult at this stage in the NBA. The Jalen uprising has come. And we can sort of, like, dramatically reconfigure who we've been on the fly, but still be super athletic, super aggressive, super defensively capable, and just, like, tweak what this guy can do, because turns out when you let Amen Thompson be your ostensible five on offense, he's going to shoot like 65% at the rim or 70% at the rim and be able to make plays in the short roll, the connecting passes you were talking about. Like, he's a 6'7", 1-4 plus defender who also can play five on offense. Like, it's a weird skill set, but I mean, I've talked on this show in the past about him and his brother being kind of like the evolutionary versions. Like, if you got free Darko guys today, like, this is your version of, like, what a Josh Smith would have been, or what a Gerald Wallace would have been, these sorts of players. Like, we're getting to see what those guys look like if a league understood how to use them at 20. And seeing that guy be able to be that sort of versatile piece in a playoff run or a potential postseason run has been really fascinating. The reason, though, and we've got to mention this part, the reason that they are in this position right now is Jalen Green is on, like, an all-time heater. The last, I think since Şengün went down, let me pull up the numbers here, 30.7 points per game since Şengün went down, 50, 46, 80 shooting. He's made four or more threes 9 times in the last 13 games. So he's just bombing away, like, off the catch, off the pull, whatever, and just, like, stroking it. This is what I think the most optimistic upside of what Jalen Green could look like has been or was when they picked him number 2 overall. But I don't know if everybody kind of saw it coming this soon and then in this way.
Yeah, I mean, I wrote something about them earlier this season about how hiring Ime Udoka and signing Fred VanVleet and Dylan Brooks and Jock Landale, like, it gave them sort of a professionalism to the operation that allowed you to actually evaluate all of these young guys on their team. And, you know, it was early on in the year and Jalen Green was shooting, you know, like 40% from the field, 30% from three. And one of the things that I focused on was how it seemed like every single shot he was taking off the dribble, he was drifting to his left or drifting to his right. He would never just go straight up and down. And that was one of the things that frustrated me so much about him. And I feel like he's had better balance on those type of shots lately, but he's also making the off balance shots, which is a big change from where he was, you know, for the first, what is it, 2.5 years of his career. And if he's going to be able to make those off balance shots, that changes things dramatically. But if he's just on balance more, that does too. And I don't know what it is about these last few weeks. Like, is it just March basketball? Is it something that, you know, clicked into his head from the coaching? Is it like knowing that he has to carry the offense without Şengün? Like, whatever it is, they need to bottle up whatever he's done with his jumper over these last few weeks and with the confidence he has in the jumper, which is something that I think that contributed to the, like, you know, I'm trying to fade away. So like, I am like putting the spin and touch on the ball while I'm in the air or something like that. I don't know exactly what it is, but whatever has been going on these last few weeks with that, they need to keep it exactly like that.
Especially because it's all, he's been doing that and it hasn't come at the, you know, the disservice or the detriment of whatever gains he's made on the other side of the court. Like, he's averaging 7 rebounds a game in this stretch too. Like, that's not, you know, that engine room kind of dirty work on the defensive glass is not the kind of guy he has been or that you'd expect him to be. But with the athleticism, with the length, he's taken a step on the defensive end. Our guy Kelly Eco at The Athletic had written a good piece about that earlier this week, like Udoka praising him for better effort, better energy on that end. And that's, I think, to the point that you made about the professionalism, right? About like, if you've got Fred VanVleet there, you've got Dylan Brooks there, Jock Landale to some degree, Jeff Green, like another, just like a veteran, there is a standard established. If you do not put in this requisite level of effort and, you know, nail your job, you're going to be held accountable for it. And you see yourself on camera on the film, you know, getting roasted for like, these are the mistakes that you're making. This is not to the standard that we hold up. And that was the thing with the Rockets sort of throughout the season. The beginning of the season, I wrote about their defense and the steps that they'd taken, but they went through that slide midseason and the offense was kind of in the toilet. And you're like, well, they're going to fall out of contention here. But even as that happened, the defense stuck around. They were still like, top 5, top 6, so around there in points allowed per possession. And like that establishes your floor and gives you an opportunity to stick around. And then like you get that, you combine that with one of your guys goes on a heater, Fred VanVleet suddenly starts hitting a bunch of threes too. And like you can kind of be right back in that thing if you hit a strong pocket in the schedule and the guys above you start to dip. And like, so this is an opportunity where there's an object in the rearview mirror or closer than they appear component for the Lakers, for the Warriors. But it's not just them falling all over themselves. To some degree, it is that. But we're reframing and accentuating the positive today. Houston deserves a ton of credit for keeping themselves in the fight here and then putting themselves in a position where, yeah, maybe it's, you know, the vicissitudes of March basketball. But, like, you got to win the games. And they're doing that and putting themselves in a position where they're over 500, 70-plus games into the season, which is the first time since Harden was there. Like that, there is something to be said for like getting yourself in the conversation.
Yeah, definitely. And like there was, frankly, a lot of low-hanging fruit available to them to improve this season. Like the last two seasons of Rockets basketball were not pretty. Like I could barely watch them last year. And, you know, in the spirit of reframing things, like you said, like they have taken all that low hanging fruit and, you know, picked it and tried to eat it. Like they have done things in a much more, like, I know what they're trying to accomplish on both ends of the floor, which is not something that you could say for the last 2 years. And I think with Green specifically on defense, as you mentioned it, like, the tools have always been there for him to be a good defender. He's a ridiculous athlete. He's really long. He has, you know, incredible size for a wing player. Like it's just about teaching him what to do and getting him to execute it. And, you know, this is only Ime's what second season as a coach, but I think we've seen like, he clearly knows how to get guys to know what to do on that end of the floor. And, you know, maybe that changes over the course of his career, but it seems like the kind of thing, like, if you're a good defensive coach, that tends to follow you. And like, I think they've been defending over the talent level of the defenders on the roster for most of the year. You know, especially, you know, on the interior, Şengün is like a short armed kind of guy. Like, it's not necessarily what you would think of as a rim protector, but if you can get more out of your personnel than what they have available, that's good coaching. And I think that's a good sign that they are more open to being coached and more capable of taking coaching than it seemed like they were over the last 2 years.
Absolutely. The trajectory looks a lot, you know, a lot more optimistic, or there's a lot more optimism in what's going on there this point this year than there was, you know, 6 months ago, however long. And that's something to really be excited about. I'm wondering if we're going to wind up like kind of copying, pasting that bit for the next one, but a team in a very similar set of circumstances, which is a lot of S sounds that I said quickly, where you got a team that has sort of developed an identity, established who it wants to be. It starts on the defensive end and it starts with a lot of young talent. Say something nice to me about the Orlando Magic.
Yeah, I kind of think Jamal Mosley should win coach of the year. Like, to have whatever they are. Like, I think they're like the fourth youngest team and the fourth best defense or something along those lines. I don't remember the exact numbers. I haven't checked in the last week or so, but that's incredible, especially when you consider that guys like, you know, Paolo and Franz coming into the league weren't necessarily thought of as like elite kind of defenders. You know, when they got Wendell Carter and Mo Wagner as their centers, who aren't necessarily traditional like rim protector types, but the way that they defend on a string, the way that they are able to cut off drives it's really impressive. The way that they're sort of systematized on defense and the way they execute within what Mosley wants them to do is really impressive. They lost guys for significant stretches of the season. They basically haven't had any guards other than Jalen Suggs healthy for the entire year. And I mean, like, Suggs is up there with Amen Thompson for me in terms of my favorite guys to watch. Like, it's like a guy built picture perfect for me to love watching him.
Yeah.
It's just, I find a lot of really things nice about the Magic.
Well, who needs guards? I mean, the entire premise of the Orlando Magic is like, what if we build the whole plane out of huge, long guys that can do a little bit of everything? And then the guards are kind of like, yeah, if they come along, great. But like, we're mostly just going to be gigantic. And they've, over the last couple of years, they've decided, and this is a real interesting wrinkle for the Magic over the last 15 or so years, what if those guys could score? What if those guys could do stuff with the ball in their hands? And that's like a really interesting wrinkle they've added. I think to me, and you know, I know it's a little bit of a, it's becoming an easy talking point, but I love easy talking points because I talk and sometimes I have a hard time with it. The fact that they've learned how to really leverage Paolo Banchero's passing, like his scoring to open things up for passing. And I'm thinking specifically of the way he works out of the post. Like, he understands now, like, if you get a mismatch there, if they're able to work, you know, getting him off a cross screen and he's able to set up on the block, he's good enough that he can overpower guys to get to the basket. He can, you know, turn around face up and shoot over the top. And he knows now, like, he's been good enough at that for a year and a half, almost 2 years, that teams are starting to show more help at him and throw more doubles at him when he gets there, in part because they don't believe, as we mentioned, like the guards, you know, the shooting around him, like, all right, make those guys beat us. Well, he's doing that. He's making those reads earlier. He's making the feeds more. And you've got more of those guards and those wings like moving around the arc, understanding if we get into a good spot, he will find us. He's averaging 6 assists a game since January 1st. Like, that is a level up significantly over where he was last year when he was the rookie of the year. And if you have that guy who's creating an advantage and then spraying it out and sharing it, some of those looks are a little bit easier when you're catching them in rhythm. You're catching them with a little bit more space before the closeout defender. And that's where, you know, Jalen Suggs making the advancements that he's made as a 3-point shooter. You know, Cole Anthony is a guy that can catch and shoot a lot more. You know, even Franz being able to catch, but then also beat a closeout, get downhill. Like, there are just more ways for you to win when you've already got the advantage created. And now you're looking at how do you extend it. And to me, that's just such a, it is indicative, as you said, of Jamal Mosley, the great job he's done on the coaching, not just on the defensive end, but also, don't tell me so much about what these guys can't do. Let me see what I can make out of what we do have and what they can do. And it does feel a little bit like he's getting the most out of them. On the offense has not been elite, obviously. That's going to be their big concern. But even on that end, they're sort of trending up that way more recently. I think they're above average on offensive efficiency since the All-Star break. I think like 10th in the half court. They're generating more corner threes. Like, they're figuring out answers to the ways teams guard them. And then, I mean, whether that holds up in a playoff series, I don't know. But if you would have told me, you know, beginning of last season or midway through last season, we're going to be finding out pretty soon what the Magic do in a playoff series, I would have thought you were nuts. So to get here this early feels like a real big win organizationally.
Definitely. And I'm glad you brought up Paolo's passing. It's coincidentally something I'm putting in my three things I noticed on the test for tomorrow. All right.
We're noticing.
Because... yeah, I think he had like the best passing game of his career against New Orleans last week. And specifically the kind of stuff you mentioned, like passing out of a double from the post. One time in each half, he got that and he just like whipped a one-handed pass across the court over the top of two helpers to a guy who was getting like a hammer screen in the corner. And, you know, Gary Harris made it, and I think either... or Gary Harris missed it and Jalen Suggs made it in the second half. But both of them were just... like incredible passes. And then a few of them like on pocket passes to Wendell Carter or the pick and roll, or finding guys like, you know, jump passes are good now, thanks to
Shouts out to Caitlin Cooper and our friend Tyrese Halliburton. Yep, that's right.
Yeah. And he made a few of those in that game as well. Like, I remember before the All-Star break, I was like, I kind of think Franz has outplayed Paolo to this point in the season. And I think since then, like since maybe like a week or two before the All-Star break, Paolo has taken it to a completely different level. And he did have that one stretch like where Franz was out early in the year and he was posting ridiculous numbers for a week and a half. But then as the absence went on, and as like Carter was out and, you know, Fultz was out, and like, I don't know how many guys they've had out different times this year, but it sort of seemed like he sort of crumbled under the weight of having to do everything for a couple weeks. And I kind of think it helped them. Like, so much of the discourse about the Magic has been how they need more playmakers and they need, you know, like a real point guard. Asking Paolo and Franz to do so much creating has sort of helped them level up their creating. And you brought up, they've always had these, you know, big, long, athletic guys, and it's just none of them have been able to create. Like, the guys that are in the front office there, John Hammond and Jeff Weltman, have both come from organizations where they really valued big, long, athletic guys in the Bucks and the Raptors. The Raptors tried to build a similar sort of team where it was all big, long, athletic guys, but the big issue with them since Kawhi left was they didn't have anybody to create advantages for anybody else, so they couldn't score in the half court. And now it's like the Magic are building that sort of team, and they have two guys that can create those sort of advantages. Like, they're not elite-level creators yet necessarily, but they're on their way to getting there. And that's, like, it's really impressive for them. It's really impressive for the coaching. And it's really impressive to be able to get what they're able to get out of the talent they have on hand, given they do have deficiencies.
Absolutely. And we'll move off of it in a second, but I just love that idea of, if someone gives you a toolbox, or you, like, you know, you find one in the apartment as you move into it, and it's like, well, all there is in here is a hammer. Like, and you can be like, well, it sucks to not have a screwdriver and a wrench. Or you can be like, I'm going to use this friggin' hammer. And what the Magic do is they use the friggin' hammer. They're like, we're going to take like 45% of our shots at the basket. We, like, Paolo is a guy who's going to draw fouls. We're going to use that, like, you know, him and Franz is hammering the paint to get to the line. This is what we're going to build. And maybe it's not going to be enough to win several playoff series because we're going to need a little bit more shooting, or we're going to need a little bit more creativity or whatever. But, like, turns out you can get an awful long way just hammering stuff. Like, you can fix a lot of stuff and you can break a lot of stuff with just the hammer. So, like, the shouts out to the Magic for finding a way to look at a toolbox that only had one thing in it, or what seemed like it only had one thing in it, and, you know, get to fighting for home court advantage in the first round of the playoffs. Freaking crazy. But I'm fascinated to see where they're going to, how they're going to, you know, net out in a postseason series. Cause I think they're going to take a pound of flesh out of whoever they play. I don't know if that's going to be enough for them to, you know, advance, but I think they're going to get to learn a lot about themselves and how teams are going to defend them, whether they've got enough juice to be able to beat it. And you know, we'll go from there. This one's a little bit trickier, especially, you know, we're recording this on Tuesday morning after a Monday night game that didn't necessarily cover it in glory. Do you frame it in the way that we did the other ones. Do you have any warm words of encouragement for the Phoenix Suns?
I love the possessions where Booker, KD, and Beal all touch the ball. And I would like
imagine
to see
that.
More
they
of
do
them,
things
please.
Together. Yeah, right.
Yeah. I tried to see if, like, on Second Spectrum, there's a way to track, like, what their offensive rating is on those possessions. But it doesn't have, like, you know, this player touched the ball on this possession. You can't really find that. I might, like, there's some people in the NBA stats department that might be able to figure that out. But I feel like it's, like, 240 on the possessions that they all touch the ball. There, you know, a lot of people have talked about how much of their offense is, like, KD's isolating, Booker's in the corner, Booker's isolating, Beal is in the corner. You know, even beyond your turn, my turn, it's like your turn for 3 minutes, my turn for 3 minutes.
Yes.
It's like, I just want to see everybody more involved with each other. And whether that's using Yusuf Nurkic as like a connector piece between sides of the offense, which I think is something that the Kings do really well, where mm-hmm. Sabonis will sort of connect Fox to Monk or Fox to Murray or Monk to Barnes or whatever it is, like figuring out a way to do that. And I think Nurk did a lot of that in Portland with Dame and CJ. Whatever it is, they need to get these guys working together more. Have KD set a pin down for Booker. When you're running that KD pin down set, use Beal as the screener. Like, just get these guys working off each other more often and causing problems for the defense, because when they do that, it works incredibly well for very obvious reasons.
Yeah, it turns out that when you have three all-star and better than that level creators who also can shoot well off the ball, who also can move well off the ball, and you let that, you either let them or make them do stuff at the same time, a defense is going to have its head on a swivel trying to freak out and figure out what's going on with it. So yeah, the glass half full, Dan, glass half full. when they have, even with some of the your turn, my turn, when they've got all three of those guys on the floor together, plus 8 per 100 possessions, which is like the Thunder's full season net rating. And the Thunder, if you're catching up now, real good. They've been real good all year. Score 125.5 points per 100 with those three guys on the court, which is like Celtics best in the league level. They haven't defended great, but they've defended well enough in those minutes, especially when they've had Nurkic on the floor. And Nurkic is not a great rim protector. He's sort of similar in kind to what you were talking about with Şengün earlier, where it's like, this guy is not a great rim protector, but he's huge and he moves his feet well, so he can be in the way, which is also one of his great skills on offense. The number of times the Spurs broadcast got mad about him making those like Gortat moving screens on the roll to the rim last night. Like, they're like, this is like, at a certain point, it's like, yeah, he shouldn't be allowed to do that. And you're like, well, you're being very kind, but you can just yell at that. Yeah, he's doing something illegal, but he's getting away with it because of the twinkle toes.
I think Zach Collins was even more angry than they were.
Zach Collins is always the most angry, I think. Like, he might be, like, in terms of just, like, rage per capita. There's a little, like, a little Wolverine going on in that guy, which, listen, you got to have whatever edge you need to compete. I understand it. But Zach Collins, sometimes I'm like, are you, like, happy about anything? You seem like you're very mad. But listen, I mean, there's plenty to be mad about when you're losing as much as the Spurs have. I understand that. And when everyone is like, by the way, the only good version of this team is with you not on the court. Like, the one that everyone's excited about does not involve you. Maybe I would be mad if I was him, too. So, well, again, go back to reframing. I see you, Zach Collins. I understand where you're coming from. The things that where they struggle on, you know, Phoenix, like the one of the big ones is that as good as their offense has been and efficient as their offense has been throughout the first three quarters, falls off a cliff in the fourth, and it's been one of the worst in I think dead last in offensive efficiency in the fourth quarter. One of the worst in the clutch. A lot of those issues level out when you've got the main three guys on the court. The big issue, of course, is just they haven't had the main three guys on the court all that often. And now it's pretty late in the game. And so they are now facing a like absolute murderer's row schedule of the last 10 games as they try to get into the playoff hunt there. coming off an unacceptable loss. That's not my words. That is Frank Vogel said that, and Kevin Durant said that after the loss to San Antonio. They got to go to Denver. They got to go to Oklahoma City. They got to go to New Orleans. They're gonna have to deal with the Pelicans again. They're gonna have to, I think, a home and home with the Clippers. They've got the Timberwolves coming up. Like, it's just a lot of really good teams coming up. And so I guess the reframe on that is you will have opportunities to prove the case that we, when we have our guys on the court, we can beat anybody. They beat Denver not too long ago in the, one of the best games after the All-Star break. There is a capacity with Kevin Durant playing at an All-NBA level, Bradley Beal really accepting the role as that facilitating, you know, number one kind of point guard, the lead initiator. We know what Devin Booker can be with the bright lights on. This is the time to prove it. So good news, guys. You've created the adversity for yourself, and now you get to overcome it.
Yeah, I mean, they've got every single one of their games left is against a team that's currently in the top six in their conference. Like, their schedule is
good
so
luck,
much
guys.
Harder than the
Enjoy
next
yourselves.
Closest team. This was the theory of the team that everybody had before the season. It's like, well, you know, when those three guys are healthy, they're going to be pretty damn good. But also the likelihood that they're ever going to be healthy for an extended stretch is pretty low. And that's exactly what has happened throughout the season. And then, you know, Beal and Nurkic both got hurt in that game last night. Like, now that going into this stretch, like, maybe not having one or two of those guys for some of those games, like, exactly what we thought the team would be is exactly what they have become. The ceiling is very high. The floor is lower than you think it is, because when you only have one of those guys or two of those guys, it's really difficult because of how much thinner beyond the top three guys and then beyond, like, Nurk and Grayson Allen when he's hitting every shot. Like, there's a lot of limited guys elsewhere on the roster, and it's like, when all of those three guys are there, that doesn't matter as much. When only two of them are there, it matters a little bit more, and when only one of them is there, it matters a lot more. Like, so it's just, it's difficult. They've made it difficult on themselves, but, you know, they have an opportunity to beat all of these teams down the stretch. They have an opportunity to prove it to themselves, I guess, down the stretch, that they could beat all of these teams. So in the interest of reframing, those are technically good things, but it's going to be really difficult.
Speaking of someone who likes things difficult and who is something of an adversity merchant in and of himself, I'm going to shift gears a little bit because I'm interested to see where you would take it. Say something nice about Tom Thibodeau.
He has...
I can feel the hesitation. All right. Yeah, let's go for it.
Yeah. He has surprised me with his willingness to change the lineup. Early in the season, he moved Dante DiVincenzo in for Quentin Grimes, and where would they be right now if that didn't happen? And then more recently, he moved Miles McBride into the starting lineup in place of Precious Achiuwa when they had been starting that big group with Julius Randle and OG Anunoby out, because there was a game against the Warriors where they just completely ignored Achiuwa, like, as if he wasn't on the floor. And then the next time they played the Warriors, they put McBride out there. And this is something I've harped on for ever since Tibbs got to the Knicks, and especially since they got Brunson. When teams are pressuring him and when they're putting size on him, you need another ball handler out there. This is why I would never shut up about playing Brunson and Emmanuel Quickly together more often, and how horrible it was that they completely buried Quickly after one bad half in the first half of game one of the playoffs last year. Like, having that other ball handler out there, having another shooter out there, is so valuable when teams are so keyed on Brunson. And for him to belatedly finally realize that with a guy who is even smaller than Quickly, which was this whole thing about not playing Brunson and Quickly together. Like, thank you for learning. Let's just now play him less than 43 minutes sometimes.
Well, you can't always get what you want. He's going to continue to play more than 43 minutes almost all the time. I introduced this with a little bit of a smirk on my face because, you know, you and I both Knicks fans by ancestral damage and provincialism, and are familiar with the frequent refrains of the criticism of Tom Thibodeau for being a little bit too rigid in his approach to things, not being creative enough offensively, being married so much to certain guys and certain lineups and not to others. And I think this is a, you know, maybe there's a version of it that's sort of like, this is his cool Woody season, where it's like injuries forced him to do other stuff than he would necessarily be comfortable doing and find other answers. And so like if Julius Randle was there, Julius Randle was going to play 39 minutes in the way that Julius Randle plays. Without him, yes, there's the go small more often. There's play more guys who are maybe better suited, are not isolation players, but better suited to do things like get into dribble handoff games when teams ignore them. You know, you've got Josh Hart and Isaiah Hartenstein, and, you know, them being somebody like, we can find other ways to get creative when teams are trying to sag off of us. The same coverages that we use to defang Cleveland, we can figure out ways to beat them ourselves. Leaning more on guys. Like, I thought that Precious Achiuwa was going to be the kind of guy that Thibodeau would see make a mistake and then be like, you are excised to Siberia and never playing for me again. But he, like, that guy played a little, he played well, he showed something in the minutes, and Tibbs, maybe because of, you know, he needed to, he just had no other options, but gave him more rope. Deuce McBride had, you know, he was not necessarily, I mean, they got Alec Burks for a reason. They were like, we need another shot creator, another shot maker off the bench. But then Deuce McBride started playing well, and Tibbs was like, all right, I'm going to give you more of an opportunity here. So there's a flexibility and a willingness to try something new that I think we maybe haven't necessarily seen from Tibbs in years past. And it has served this team really, really well. You wrote a great chunk at Last Night in Basketball about the way he's moved Brunson off the ball more, making Brunson sort of using him more like Steph Curry as a, you know, running around off ball screens. It's been helped declench that offense a lot more. It's made Brunson a more versatile and even more dangerous player. This is not the kind of stuff that we saw Tibbs doing, right? Like finding creative answers to some of these problems. He has the hammer in the toolbox, and he's not going to look around for, even if you had a full toolbox, he wouldn't look around for the other things. He would just use the hammer. So shouts out to Tom Thibodeau for, finding some other tools in the toolbox. I want to kind of go quickly through some of
just quickly. Go ahead. I'm glad you brought up the Mike Woodson season, because I think an important point to distinguish between the two is that in the 2012-13 season, which I'm assuming is the season that you're talking about,
yeah,
they were forced by injuries to go small, but then as soon as they weren't, Woodson went away from it.
Yes.
He kept trying to go away from what was making the team good, and ultimately he did it again in the playoffs against the Pacers, and it doomed them. And then in the very next series, the Heat were like, oh, well, we're going to beat the Pacers by playing – you know, Chris Bosh at the five and going five out. And even the Pacers were like, yeah, we couldn't deal with that.
Yeah.
Tibbs, to his credit, is leaning into the things that are making them better with the injuries instead of trying to go away from them at every opportunity.
And my reframing there, instead of sinking into a deep pit of despair about Carmelo Anthony getting blocked at the summit, my reframe is going to be Chris Copeland was pretty sweet. I enjoyed watching Chris Copeland play. All right, I want to try to go quickly through a couple more here. I mean, we're saying so many nice things about these other teams. We've got to get to a couple of more pretty quickly. And this might be a little challenging. Do you have any glass half full stuff on the state of affairs in Brooklyn?
The arena is very close to my apartment. When Lonnie Walker has gotten a chance to play, my guy from Miami, he's shot the ball.
This is Miami stuff. This is not all right, fair enough. Go ahead.
Yeah. He's shot the ball really well. I think Nick Claxton could get himself paid this summer, maybe. Not like at a huge level, but he could get like a pretty nice contract. There hasn't been much great for the Nets, but it's convenient for me when I go to games. They have my guy playing well when he is playing, and they have interesting guys. It's like guys that if they were on good teams would be good, but they're all on the same team and there's nobody to make them good enough for those guys to be good, if that makes sense.
No, absolutely. And that ties to what the best I came up with, and this is admittedly a cold cup of coffee, so I'm sorry to our fellow Brooklynites. And to the Brooklyn Knight, if he's out there somewhere haunting the rafters, you at least have more clarity about what you have in Mikal Bridges. Like I wrote about Mikal Bridges toward the end of last year. Jake wrote about him earlier this season. You know, plenty of people looked at the Mikal Bridges sort of growth after he got there in the second half of last season and said, maybe they've already got an all-star on the team. And maybe Mikal Bridges can be a, you know, fringe all-star guy that's in that conversation. But what we've seen now is like, it doesn't look like the shot creation profile and the like a high level, high usage, high efficiency, number one guy. Like that's, I think we can say that's probably not the way this is going to work out for Mikal Bridges. He can be a very good number two, maybe very good number three on a really, you know, top end team. I think that's a way you can say it. You need the guy to create the advantages for him to exploit more than he's going to be able to do that for somebody else. And the frustrating thing is, if that is the highest end outcome for him, maybe they would have been better off entertaining some of those multiple pick offers for him at the last couple of trade deadlines or in the offseason. But either way, I mean, that's sort of a sunk cost. You can't recreate those circumstances. At least now you know what kind of what you need to be looking at moving forward as the Nets are going to look for a new way of doing things as they are about to hand like a top eight pick to the Rockets. It's a tough set of circumstances right now, but knowing is better than not knowing. Let's go there. At least knowing is better than not knowing. And speaking of knowing being better
Mikal
than not
gets
knowing,
to go on a, Mikal gets to go on the podcast with his friends, even though they're making fun of him for being like SpongeBob or whatever that was that Josh Hart said.
Speaking of the Josh Hart quote machine that you were talking about. Yeah, it was after the Knicks beat the Nets. They asked him what it was like to watch Mikal, their former Villanova buddy. And it said, it's like he's Squidward in the meme where he's behind the bars watching Patrick and SpongeBob have fun. It's like, that's cold, man. Like, come on. But also, you know, in every joke, some truth. I think Josh Hart maybe is, he maybe doesn't need to be that honest about his friend's plight, but I think there's something to that. But speaking of, you know, not ideal sets of circumstances, but so if nothing else, teams that I need to mention, because I keep finding ways to not write or talk about them. The Bulls and the Hawks, all right? What I've got here is a sort of a general framing is like not the most inspiring race for 9 and 10 I've ever seen in my life, but there's something to be said for trying to win even when it might even be beneficial or rational for you to not do it. Like there are competitive guys competing hard, even in sets of circumstances where you would understand if they folded up the 10 or if the front office went in another direction. Like DeMar DeRozan, I trust he's going to get a shot off when it matters, and I believe more often than not it's going to go in. Alex Caruso, I believe that guy is going to blow up, you know, four different actions on a possession when it matters. Like the Hawks, they lose Trae Young and they keep competing. Like there's something to be said for that, even if it's, I don't think it's going to result in a whole heck of a lot more than, you know, for one of them, one play and loss, and then for one of them, you know, maybe two play, or you know, maybe they get to eight and then they deal with the Celtics. I don't know, but I don't have a whole lot on them, but Jared, maybe you can help me out here.
Yeah, I think for Chicago at different points this season, Kobe White and Ayo Dosunmu have both played really, really well. You know, Kobe White for, you know, a longer stretch, I think, and Dosunmu more recently, but to get those two guys playing at a high level and, you know, particularly White, who looked like possibly sub NBA player level early on, like very early on, and then morphed into the kind of player that you don't necessarily want on your team. But this year, basically since LaVine went out early in the year, has just been awesome. And then Dosunmu, like finding the right way to use the kind of skill that he has within the context of like, okay, you know, DeMar and Vucevic and Kobe are going to be the top offensive options, but this is what I can do offensively. These are the types of things that I could do defensively with my size and my length. Like, I think that has, both of those things have been really good for them. And then with Atlanta, like DeJounte Murray level up without Trae Young, obviously, has been really impressive. And then I think like their centers have all played well at times. Like Bruno Fernando, when given the opportunity, has been pretty decent. I love Onyeka Okongwu still, if he can stop fouling. And even Clint Capela, like, despite not having, you know, his law partner in Trae Young, like, he can do things with DeJounte. So, you know, there are somewhat silver linings, even if, like you said, like, it would probably be better for both of them to just, like, get into the lottery.
Yeah, the Hawks being, like, about league average on defense since Trae Young went down. Like, it's never as simple as one thing, but sometimes it's like, you know, sometimes you can – correlation and causation might not be totally separated from one another in some of those sets of circumstances.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting too, because Trey was trying more than ever on defense this year, and it still wasn't working.
But trying is a very important thing to do. We praise the effort here. It's not just about the result. It's about the effort that you put into it. It's what I tell, what I talk to my kids about with school. We can talk about it with Trae Young and his defense. Well, now that I've reframed Trae Young into a child, that's not really nice of me. I should back up on that. That's not the kind of reframing we were going for here. I'll try to get myself together here. Before we go any further, we're going to take a quick break, pay some bills. I'm going to figure out how to speak more kindly about everybody, and then we'll be right back with some more Divine Intervention. Welcome back to Divine Intervention. We are here with Jared Dubin from Last Night in Basketball, and we are going to move into something we like to call the closing five, kind of a wrap-up segment here on the show. As I'm sure you know, Jared, how you start and whether you're in the starting lineup is not nearly as important as how you finish and whether you're on the floor to close games. So five questions for our illustrious guest. Question number one, kind of a timely topic with the NCAA tournament going on, G League Ignite shutting down, stuff like that. You wrote a few years back that you would want to see the NBA eliminate the age limit and let players enter the league whenever they want. I think that's an interesting way to think about it that a lot of people might not necessarily think about because they love the draft. Why were you sort of on board for that? And do you still think that that's a good idea?
Yes. I mean, I think it's a good idea because, like, I want players to be able to enter the league whenever. Like, I think that if you want to go professional and make money playing basketball and you think you're good enough, like, you should be able to try that. And if you're not good enough, the league will tell you that. But you also get the chance to make some money in the meantime, especially now that I think next year they're going to have 30 G League teams for the first time, if I'm remembering correctly. And it can be used more like a real minor league system. And we've seen teams be more willing to take like first round picks and lottery picks even and send them to the G League. They're more willing to invest in that type of development. Like, even if the G League Ignite is not there, which, you know, I don't know how successful necessarily that's been as a development pipeline. But like, I want people to be able to do what's best for them professionally, essentially. And I think that is a good idea. And if it's on the teams to discover which 18-year-olds actually are ready and which aren't, I think that's better than removing the ability for them to decide for themselves.
Yeah, putting in sort of an artificial impediment and saying, like, you know, even if you might be ready, we're not going to let you do it yet. If we're not going to dismantle the draft altogether, which is, you know, certainly we can start blowing up more things if we want to. That's fine by me. But age limit, yeah, I like that idea as well. I think that makes a ton of sense. Speaking of professional adjustments, question number two, you started writing about sports, as you mentioned earlier, while you were in law school, and you are an actual, in fact, lawyer. I'm wondering, is there anything about your legal training that you think has helped you in this world outside of the part where you just realized you didn't want to be a lawyer, so you decided to go do something else?
Well, I would say I'm technically a lawyer, as if I still have my license. Technically, I'm also retired as a lawyer, so I don't have to pay the bar dues.
Wait. You had to like say I'm retiring.
Yeah,
that's incredible. Congratulations! You're the first retiree I've had on the show. That's wonderful to know.
Yeah, I don't know if it was necessarily a choice for me to not be a lawyer. I went to law school at basically the worst time in the history of the New York legal market. I graduated in 2012, which was like, you know, essentially two or three years post everything happening in the financial crash.
Yes.
And I remember, for example, my friend's brother, who was 3 years older than us, went to law school. So he graduated law school the year that I graduated from college, and his firm that he eventually worked at paid him like a percentage of his salary to not take a job for a year so that he could then work there. But like, so it was delaying all of these people coming into the workforce. So by the time I got out of law school, I was doing like contract work as a foreclosure mediator, which is like exactly as soul-sucking and horrible as it sounds. But during all of this time, I started writing during the lockout because none of my friends wanted to talk to me about basketball. So I just kind of started writing and like, you know, started on Twitter. And I believe that's like at the No Season Required tour from what was then the Basketball Jones.
That's right.
Believe that's where we met for the first time. at like the New York show, I met you and Seth Rosenthal and Jason Concepcion and Jared Wade and Graydon Gordian and like the Basketball Jones guys and Beckley Mason and like all of these different people that turned out to be like, you know, colleagues in different times and different things, you know, collaborators at different times. And so it worked out well in that sense. But to go back to your actual question, which was, do I think it's helped me at all? I think it has in some ways. Like, I have that kind of like analytical and explanatory brain, which is kind of the lane that I find myself in a lot of the time. And then just knowing things about the way the legal system works, I think has helped me understand the salary cap, which is way more complicated than it has any right to be.
Sure.
So I definitely think it's helped in some ways, just in terms of the way I think and being able to explain complicated concepts. And probably the only class I ever took in any level of school that has actually been worth anything was called persuasion in law school.
Sure.
And so that was really helpful.
That makes a ton of sense. I mean, what I think my main takeaway is you're welcome for all of the advice that I gave you at that Basketball Jones live show, which if I remember right, it was mostly, I'm like, I had like two or three beers and was like, I don't know. I'm trying to say hi to as many people as possible because these guys, like the Basketball Jones guys basically put me on. And then I was, you know, it was like, you were able to be friends with everybody else that was there. I took one class that was very helpful to me as an undergrad. It was just like an intro to lit class. And the main reason that it was helpful was that the professor, shouts out to Bill Friend, was like, everybody in your life is going to say, you want to study English? What are you going to do with that? And you just have to lie. He said, you got to come up with a story that's good enough to lie. You can sell them on when you go home for like Thanksgiving break. You'd be like, oh, well, you know, a lot of firms need people in their communications departments or whatever. And they'll go, oh, okay. And then you can just go on and go read books and write. And then like that'll be how you move forward in your conversations with people that are mad that you're not doing finance. So every once in a while, we find what we need in those courses. So shouts out to Bill Friend and to your persuasion class.
I did finance, so.
Well, I mean, listen, I can't argue with it. You wound up in the right place with you're writing about ball for a living. So you're on the side of the angels. Question number three. You once wrote at Grantland that it's time to move away from retread NBA coaches. Now, it's been a long time since that published, but that is, it's been sort of interesting to see how that has evolved. Now, three of the last four champions are led by coaches that have, you know, been on their second job or after that. I'm wondering, is there anything that you think has sort of changed about the kinds of coaches that are getting retreaded, or is it maybe just like a higher class of options that are getting sort of cycled through there?
That's a good question. I'd love to look into the last, because I think I wrote that probably like 2012, 2013 range.
Yeah, I think it's like been like 10 years. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'd love to look at the last 10 years of data on what kinds of teams that retread coaches have taken over. You know, for like Mike Budenholzer going and taking over Giannis's team. That's right. Pretty helpful. Frank Vogel going and taking over LeBron's team. That's pretty helpful. So I would definitely be very interested to see that. I do think it's interesting that a lot of the teams that are like the coach of the year types this year, you know, we talked about Jamal Mosley, Mark Dagnall in Oklahoma City, Chris Finch in Minnesota. Like a lot of these guys that are leading like the young upstart teams are also young upstart coaches, which I think is interesting. I think at the time was more talking about like these coaches that we have seen not necessarily have success elsewhere, keep getting hired for more and more jobs. And I do think some of it is like, you know, Bud's Atlanta teams were really good. Frank Vogel coached teams in Indiana that were good. Like it didn't work out in Orlando, but you know, his teams were good. Like Tibbs's Bulls teams were really good. He got another chance in Minnesota. It didn't work out. He's gotten another chance in New York, and they basically built him a prototype Tibbs team, and it's working out better. Like some of it might just be GMs getting better and, you know, hiring guys and making the teams make more sense. It also might be like the retread coaches, I think at the time, if I'm remembering correctly, got to take over better teams. And I feel like that's probably still true. Like teams aren't necessarily looking for a first-time guy to coach the really good teams because they want an experienced hand. We can see sometimes it doesn't work out when they go to an inexperienced guy like in Milwaukee this year. And then they turn to like, you know, the retread of all retreads, and Doc Rivers has coached 47 teams, you know, like, and teams do tend to swing from one extreme to the other. I would love to see like the last 10 years of data and if things have changed and how they've changed. And if my assumption that the retread coaches still get to take over better teams has held true, and how much that's contributed to like some of those guys, like having a lot of success and winning titles.
It makes a ton of sense. Yeah. The sort of sample being limited by, if you got a superstar who's like, I want a guy that I know has won a championship before, or as who has, you know, been a high level coach in big games of stars, like, it, you're winnowing down the sample there. So it makes a ton of sense. And yeah, Doc Rivers is basically like the, if you're going to like, you know, make a sculpture of this sort of, you know, the totem of this kind of coach, Doc Rivers would be the image of it. Question number four, this is a real hard hitting question. Those who follow you on Instagram know that you have an extremely cute dog named Bodhi. Tell me your favorite things about him right this instant.
Everything. Like there are a lot of
times begin with, when people, everything.
Yeah. Yeah, people will ask me things, and it's like the only two things I like at times are like basketball and my dog. So he is basically the opposite of me in terms of personality. Like he thinks everyone in the world is his best friend and just goes up to everyone and wants to like get attention from everyone. And I am not necessarily like that. I have so many more human interactions than I would because of him. And he actually like is best friends with like all of the people in my building. It's like, it's pretty funny. There's only one person or animal in our entire building that likes me more than him. And it's another dog, and she'll just run up to me like my dog runs up to everybody else. And he's sitting there and he just looked up because you said his name.
That's wonderful. And now you're going to have to play this for him later so that he gets to know my name so that we can be best friends as well. Jared, it sounds like he's reframing you. I love that. I love that for you and for him as well. Question number five, you once wrote, this is the way I start a lot of these, what you called a definitive taxonomy of facial hair on Game of Thrones. which of those facial hairstyles would you most want to, I know you are a facial hairsman, you do have a beard as I have a beard, which of those styles would you most want to rock in this real world of ours and why?
Oh man. Now I'm trying to remember all of them. Like who had the most, you know, whose beard was incredible that I hope mine looks like when I get older is, Charles Dance, who played Tywin Lannister.
Absolutely.
When my beard is all white, I hope that my beard is like as perfectly manicured and chiseled as his was.
I have to shout out one of my favorite things in this. Late Euron Greyjoy looks like Pacey Witter from Dawson's Creek started a punk band. I think that is perfect. It also dovetails several of my interests in a very nice way. And I think you deserve praise for that. So here I am praising you. The answer, though, for me, I mean, sadly, I'm probably a little more Ned Stark right before he gets his head chopped off. Spoilers for Game of Thrones. Sorry. not that sorry. It's been quite a while. Anyway. That's a wonderful choice that you've made, and something for us to aspire to. The last thing we do here on Divine Intervention is we give our guests, our listeners, a weekly recommendation. Does not have to be about the world of basketball; can be about anything. Past examples have included Outshine popsicles, going to the library, cooking someone a meal to let them know you care about them, books about facial recognition technology and the history of the ancient world, all sorts of stuff. And then also TV shows like Reservation Dogs and movies and things like that. Can be anything that you like, just something that you think is cool and good that would improve the lives of the listeners. Jared Dubin, do you have a recommendation for the people?
Yeah, I think I have a few, actually, if that's all right.
Absolutely. More the merrier.
The first one is giving shout outs, and I want to give one to my mom, who is retiring on Thursday. Shout out to her.
Shout out to Mrs. Dubin. That's incredible.
Yeah. Congratulations. Glad you don't have to work there anymore.
So that's another retiree in your family. Fantastic.
Yeah, that's true. The second one is my favorite book of all time, which is The Last Shot by Darcy Fry, which is about the Lincoln High School rail splitters team that, among others, starred a freshman, Stephon Marbury. It's not necessarily the kind of thing that's going to make you happy, but sure. It is a great book, and I read it every year, I think. I love it a lot. You mentioned TV, rewatching your favorite TV shows. Sometimes there are TV shows that you try to watch and they're just not good. The shows that you know are good and give you joy. I'm not the kind of person who can listen to music while I write because I get distracted. So I put on old TV shows that I've seen 100 times. So, you know, I'll have like Parks and Rec in the background or The Good Place, or, you know, it seems like I have a crush on Mike Schur's work. Like, I just watch, you know, all of his old shows and 30 Rock and New Girl, like old comedies that you've seen 100 times. Watch those 100 more times. Yeah. So those are my three.
Those are tremendous. I feel like my Grinch heart growing 5 sizes and breaking out of the frame, shouting out your mom on my show. This is like the kindest thing anybody's ever done. I love this. I love all of that. And mine is sort of a similar vein. The whole framing device of this episode this week was say something nice. My recommendation is say something nice. There's lots of versions of feeling in this world like you're kind of floating in space and you're all by yourself. We were literally in isolation for a very long time. We are atomized and in our own bubbles in the way we work and the way we are in the world. My version of that is I write a lot, right? I've been writing a lot for a very long time. And a lot of times that just feels like you're stuffing 100 or 1,000 or however many words into a bottle and throwing it into the ocean and having no idea if anybody's going to find it. And if they do find it, if they're going to read it or if they're just going to throw it back. So anytime anybody lets you know that they checked it out, that they dug it or not or whatever, it always feels like you're a little bit more connected in a human way. And I think that leads me to try to do that more often to other people. If I like something somebody did, to share it, like, let other people know about it. If I like something somebody did, to send them a text or send them a DM, leave that note, let them know that you dug it, that you saw them, that you recognize what they did. I guarantee you it's going to make that person's day like 1 or 2% better. And then as a result of that, it is going to make your day 1 or 2% better. And, you know, you add a bunch of those up, you wind up feeling significantly better overall. So that's my suggestion. When in doubt, say the nice thing. Make the extra effort to say the nice thing. Guarantee you it's like an assist. It's going to make two people happy. Shouts out to Nikola Jokic. Jared.
I love that. That's great.
I also would love to recommend Last Night in Basketball on Substack. As I said, I am a subscriber. It is, you know, Jared's writing 2 or 3 things every week. He's doing the video film findings on Fridays. So he's producing a video, narrating it. He's doing wonderful work there. You can find it last night. Is it lastnightinbasketball.substack.com? Is that right?
Just .com. Although I think the Substack link probably redirects there as well. I don't know for sure, but I hope it does.
Let's go clean then. Lastnightinbasketball.com. You will not regret checking it out and forking over some hard-earned cash for it. So anything else that we can point people toward on the way out the door, Jared? Anything else that you want to plug or promote?
Yeah, I still cover the NFL at cbssports.com as well. I am a big football guy, even though my favorite team is really annoying.
The Cowboys of Dallas, correct?
Yeah, I just like all the teams my dad likes, and a lot of that has been hard for me for a lot of my life. You know, the Cowboys won a bunch of Super Bowls when I was young, and I was like, this is great. My favorite team just wins every year. Like, the Cowboys won 3 Super Bowls in 4 years. The Rangers won a Stanley Cup in 1994. The Yankees won 4 World Series in 5 years. Like, I was like, this is incredible. Even the Knicks were good my whole childhood. They didn't win, but they were in the playoffs every year. They went to the finals twice. Since then, not so much with my teams being good.
You front-loaded joy toward the childhood. Yeah, there's something to be said for having a good experience when you're a kid. And then you got to know when to cut bait when you're a grown-up.
Absolutely. And, you know, at least I went to the University of Miami and they immediately went through their worst football period in 20 years.
Well, my understanding is that the next recruiting class is going to be the one that sets it all right. That's the way the U works. And, you know, Kevin Clark has informed me that the next recruiting class is going to be pretty impressive. Mario's got to go in the right direction. Jared will get you going in the right direction at lastnightinbasketball.com. You can find Jared on social media as well. JADubin5. You got to check him out there. I don't know. I'm not going to recommend the Instagram. That's going to be Jared's going to have to do that if he wants you to see Bodhi. But if you are able to befriend Jared, it's worth checking out Bodhi. That's going to do it for us on this episode of Divine Intervention. I want to say thank you so much to Jared Dubin for taking all this time to be with us and to reconnect with himself. Thank you so much to super producer John Gennaro for all the things that he does to make this show look and sound great. Vinny Goodwill and Tom Haberstroh will be back with a new episode of The Good Word tomorrow. And I will be back with Jake Fisher for another No Cap Room on Thursday here on the Ball Don't Lie podcast feed. If you like what you hear, rate, review, subscribe, give us 5 stars, let people know, share it with, give a shout out to somebody else in your life and let them know about it. We certainly appreciate that. And I think that's about it. Thank you so much for listening. Take care of yourself. You deserve it.